On February the 11th, the airfield and crews were put on full operational readiness, and when the following day a flotilla of some 30 to 40 enemy ships was spotted, multiple attacks were launched. It fell to Coastal Command in the early afternoon to try and redeem some success, and seven 217 Squadron Beauforts were ordered to launch from Thorny Island. Two were loaded with bombs instead of torpedoes, and one became unserviceable. Eventually, only four took off for Manston to rendezvous with their fighter escorts.
Just at the last minute, as I was about to press the button and release these things, I suddenly realised it wasn't a periscope, it was a fisherman's buoy for crab pots or lobster pots or something.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Welcome to Extended's Coastal Command series. I'm Peter Johnson, and I'm your host for this chapter. In this chapter, we look at the role of the RAF Coastal Command airfield at Thorny Island. At the outset of this series, the airfield at Thorny Island has always been prominent, and throughout the series, in almost every chapter, it's been mentioned. So whilst other Coastal Command airfields also played prominent roles in the war, I decided to learn more about the history of the airfield and how it was used as a Coastal Command forward operating airfield throughout World War II. The research I undertook for this chapter is authentic, but we're grateful to Robin Brooks for his support. And from reading his book, Sussex Airfields in the Second World War, it became the spark for me to research the airfield in more detail. Here is the story of RAF Thorny Island, a Coastal Command airfield, read by Gareth Stringer.
Thorny Island is an outcrop of land, broken off from its mainland connection by a small creek called Great Deep. This is in fact a peninsula, and in the coming years, with waters rising, it may break away and earn its true title. Situated on the southwestern inside boundary of the county of West Sussex, Thorny Island is almost always noted as being in Hampshire. But its location, situated just over a mile to the east of Portsmouth and at sea level elevation, made it ideal as a base for Fleet Air Arm aircraft. However, it was as a coastal command station used by the Fleet Air Arm, Bomber Command, Fighter Command and RAF Training Command that saw RAF Thorny Island utilised by almost every element of the air war in World War II. The site first came to aviation attention in September 1933 when a Hawker Fury Mark 1 crashed in a nearby field. Sadly, the pilot was killed in the crash, but as those investigating the accident noted, the fields adjacent to the crash area appeared to have great potential for an airfield, and this observation was reported back to the Air Ministry. Approval for the new airfield was rapidly obtained and construction work started in the summer of 1935. RAF Thorny Island was officially commissioned by King George VI in 1938 and found itself on a war footing in September of that same year. So, how was the airfield set up? Well, RAF Thorny Island had three runways in the now familiar triangulated A format. One runway ran from north to south, approximately 1.1 mile in length, runway 01 and 19. The north-east-south-west runway comprised of 5,124 feet, runways 06 and 24, and a smaller runway was orientated roughly northwest to southeast of 4,300 feet, runway 12 and runway 30. When first built, the runways were grass, but in 1942 these were replaced by concrete surfaces. The main hangarage was of C-type hangars, which allowed aircraft with large wingspans to be maintained out of the elements. These steel structures were clad with reinforced concrete and were situated to the northeast of the crossing runways, with other maintenance areas to the west of the field. South of these were dispersal pods for standing aircraft, with additional dispersal and aircraft parking areas to the east, close to the officers' accommodation and mess. Further hangarage came later in the form of corrugated blister hangars. The runways were connected on the outside and linked by a perimeter taxiway, and the airfield was protected by a strong defence network, including Type 22 pillboxes protecting the airfield from assault and seaborne attacks. Situated on the south, east and west of the airfield, these housed up to 5 heavy machine gun placements. There were further weapons pits, which provided additional airfield protection, and the whole seaward-facing side of the airfield was protected by a seawall on the west, and anti-tank and anti-personnel measures were in place to the south. And that wasn't all. To the south and east of Thorny Island is West Wittering, and it was here that a decoy airfield was mocked up to confuse tacks on the airfield. A false airfield layout and dummy aircraft using K-type decoys, in this case mock Blenheims, was designed to deflect for daylight raids, and at night Q-type decoys replicated the look of normal airfield night operations. The K-type decoys were in place at West Wittering by March 1940 and proved to be one of the most successful of the war, being extensively bombed during daylight operations. As a result of this success, they were only removed in June 1942, almost a year after being removed from other UK airfields. The Q-type nighttime decoys had been put in place a little later, but were also withdrawn in June 1942. In 1938, Thorny Island's first airfield commander was Group Captain J.C. Russell, who was later promoted to Air Commodore. Russell was a seasoned pilot from the First World War and experienced at running RAF airfields. But before Coastal Command could get its feet under the table, Thorny Island was transferred to the control of No. 17 Training Squadron and the School of General Reconnaissance. This decision was reversed almost immediately, however. Thorny Island reverted back to Coastal Command control on November 1, 1938, as the inevitability of war loomed on the horizon. This switch back saw No. 42 Squadron with its Vickers Wildebeest return, having previously occupied Thorny Island in the guise of 22 Squadron. Having returned to Britain in August 1936, after serving in the Abyssinian crisis in the torpedo bombing role, they started immediate anti-U-boat patrols over the Channel area south and southeast of Thorny Island. They were supported in this role by 48 Squadron's Avro Ansons in the General Reconnaissance role. At the start of the war, Thorny Island quickly became more active, with a mixture of operational sorties as well as training and aircraft conversion activities. In 1939, 42 Squadron would re-equip with the Beaufort, but did not start its first limited operational sorties until early 1940. The new Beauforts were much needed, and although they moved to RAF Bertram Newton for 2 weeks, they were to return to Thorny Island late in April, having delivered Coastal Command's first mine-laying sorties of the war off the coast of the continent. The airfield's residents grew rapidly given its strategic position, and with the war escalating quickly and the Battle of Britain looming. 48 Squadron's Ansons provided cover for the BEF over Dunkirk, and although they offered little effective offensive air power to the army below, they were able to report on both friendly and enemy movements. Quickly thereafter, converting to the Beaufort, they then found themselves grounded after problems with the aircraft's Taurus engines, and there followed a frustrating time while these problems were resolved. In June 1940, while still using the grass runways, a detachment from 235 Squadron arrived from RAF Manston, where they'd flown the Fairy Battle in the fighter role for 4 months, this time bringing the Bristol Blenheim 1F to Thorny Island for the first time. They scored several firsts in their fighter and reconnaissance role, and whilst an upgrade on the Fairy Battle, many of these airframes were quickly dispatched to Middle East and Far East squadrons, although some were also converted into a successful night fighter role. Further Blenheim 1Fs arrived that month, with 236 Squadron, and 4 weeks later, 59 Squadron arrived with Blenheim 4s, which saw them take on the now more familiar Coastal Command role, bombing shipping in French ports directly from Thorny Island. As the dawn of the Battle of Britain arrived, Thorny Island became a key target for Luftwaffe attacks. They set about taking out the fighter bases in the southern part of England, and it was believed at the time that Thorny Island had been mistaken for a fighter base and therefore bombed in the same fashion. But the Luftwaffe plan was actually a little more sophisticated. as Thorney and other Coastal Command bases were actually targeted so they could not be used to replace damaged Fighter Command airfields nearby. Luftwaffe raids occurred continually across the whole of the south of England. Many attacks on the airfield were made in that first week, but on the Sunday, now known and referred to as the hardest day, a large formation of Luftwaffe aircraft approached the south of England from over the Isle of Wight. Luftwaffe Sturzkamp Geschwader STG 77, Dive Bomber Wing 77, operating out of Caen in France, sent 28 Junkers 87 Stuka dive bombers to attack Thorney Island. Another 28 Junker 87s targeting Ford and 31 Stukas were sent to destroy the radar station at Polling. In this same raid, Dive Bomber Wing 3 had 22 Stukas attacking the airfield at nearby Gosport, a few miles west of Thorney Island. After transiting the Isle of Wight, the formation split into its attack formations and headed towards their targets in line astern formation. Air cover was being provided by ME-109s. As the bombing attack commenced on Thorney Island, 43 Squadron, the Fighting Cocks, arrived in the Hurricanes from Tangmere to break up the attack. Joined by 152 Squadron scrambling their Spitfires out of RAF Warmwell in Dorset, they were joined by 601 Squadron, known as the Millionaires, and 602, City of Edinburgh Squadron, all bouncing into the action. Reacting to the air raid sirens, Thorney's 235 Squadron Blenheims were also scrambled, but were late to the fight. A monumental air battle ensued whilst the bombing attack continued. Hitting the fuel dump, cratering the runways, and scoring a near miss on a shelter, it was undeniably a damaging attack. However, the air battle above the airfield saw devastating losses for the Luftwaffe, with at least 10 Stukas shot down and several ME-109 escorts also destroyed. Whilst the Luftwaffe hierarchy expected losses, to do so in such numbers was unsustainable. A Junkers 87 Luftwaffe pilot, Otto Schmidt, a veteran of some 65 sorties, had already hit his target, but was chased down by a Spitfire, and although damaged and with his wireless operator in the rear fatally wounded, he limped back to France. He said later, "I suppose I escaped destruction because of my desperate evasive action, but it was a truly terrifying experience. It seemed to me the attack could have been better planned, and that fighter escorts we should have had failed in their tasks." The fight continued with further attacks by Junkers 88s on Thorney Island on August the 23rd, with further substantial damage caused to the airfield. Shortly afterwards, in the chaos of war, three Blenheims from 235 Squadron on a routine patrol were attacked by a Fighter Command aircraft in a blue-on-blue error. Two were able to crawl back to the airfield, one crashing on landing, but the final Blenheim never returned and crashed into the sea with the loss of the crew. This was a huge blow to the morale of the crews and ground staff at Thorney Island, and it took time to shake off the shock of this happening. But all the while, the heavy attacks from the Luftwaffe continued. With the focus of the Luftwaffe turning to other targets, September 1940 saw the arrival of Fleet Air Arm 812 Squadron Fairy Swordfish in preparation for mine-laying operations along the coast of France, Belgium and Holland. They were temporarily attached to Coastal Command for the successful detachment, although from reports, the inter-service rivalry led to concern over the aircraft being served by crab fats. They moved between Thorney Island and North Coates over the coming months, delivering mines into the Channel and North Sea areas. Blenheim 4s from 53 Squadron and 59 Squadron joined the 235 Squadron Blenheims and undertook joint bombing operations against continental ports. This activity continuing throughout 1941, with 235 moving out of Thorney Island to Saint-Yval in the spring of 1941. The changes continued at Thorney Island, with the space created by the departure of 235 Squadron taken up by newly formed Royal Canadian Air Force 404 Squadron, the Buffaloes, with their Blenheim 4s. Joined by Royal Canadian Air Force's 407 Squadron, the Demons, neither saw operations from the airfield as they immediately converted to Lockheed Hudson's at Thorney Island and were then dispersed to other airfields across the country. But in their place, number 415 Squadron Swordfish of the Royal Canadian Air Force formed at Thorney with Beauforts. This must have been a truly fascinating time for the ground crews and support staff as the cosmopolitan nature of the crews changed with the Canadians' arrival. Stories from the squadron suggest they were fun, but not as informal as the American aircrew. More aircraft returned to Thorny Island when 22 Squadron returned from RAF Northcotes in Lincolnshire with their torpedo Beauforts, undertaking immediate operations attacking enemy shipping hugging the Belgian and French coastlines. Further Beaufort-equipped forces arrived in the form of 217 Squadron, with their motto, Woe to the Unwary, and 20 days after arriving, they converted to the Beaufort 2, this model with upgraded, more reliable US-made Wasp engines. During this time, 59 Squadron had converted to the Hudson 2 and Hudson 5s, and Thorny had seen 22, 53 and 235 Squadrons depart. The Swordfish, 415 Squadron Royal Canadian Air Force, was still resident and continued shipping torpedo strike roll. Another new squadron formed on December the 10th at Thorny, equipped with Avro Anson's to undertake the air-sea rescue role. 280 Squadron covered the Channel areas up to East Anglia and never left Thorny, disbanding there after the war. However, in 1943 they did upgrade from Anson's to the Vickers Warwick BASR Mark I. As 1941 drew to a close and the weather deteriorated, the grass runways were showing more and more damage from wear and tear. Heavier aircraft and the number of aircraft movements placed a huge toll on the grass runways, and a decision was made to upgrade them in the new year. In early 1942, Thorny Island crews were briefed and put on standby for what was to become known as the Channel Dash. On February the 11th, the airfield and crews were put on full operational readiness, and when the following day a flotilla of some 30 to 40 enemy ships was spotted, multiple attacks were launched, but all with little or no success. 6th Fleet Air Arm, 825 Squadron Swordfish, based on Thorny Island's sister airfield at Leon Solent, were launched from RAF Manston, and all were shot down, attempting to attack the German battle cruisers, who were making an audacious sprint through the English Channel to the North Sea. This is from the London Gazette of the 27th of February 1942, reporting on the Citation Award for Lieutenant Commander E. Esmond for the Victoria Cross. On the morning of Thursday the 12th of February 1942, Lieutenant Commander Esmond, in command of a squadron of the Fleet Air Arm, was told that the German battlecruisers Scharnhorst and Neisenau and the cruiser Prince Eugen, strongly escorted by some 30 surface aircraft, were entering the Straits of Dover, and that his squadron must attack before they reached the sandbanks northeast of Calais. Lieutenant Commander Esmond knew well that this enterprise was desperate. Soon after noon, he and his squadron of 6 Swordfish set course for the enemy, and after 10 minutes the flight was attacked by a strong force of enemy fighters. Contact was lost with his fighter escort, and in the action which followed, all his aircraft were damaged. He flew on, cool and resolute, serenely challenging the hopeless odds to encounter the deadly fire of the battle cruisers and their escort, which shattered the port wing of his aircraft. Undismayed, he led his squadron on, straight through this inferno of fire, in steady flight towards their target. Almost at once he was shot down, but his squadron went on to launch a gallant attack, in which at least one torpedo is believed to have struck the German battlecruisers, and from which not one of the 6 aircraft returned. His high courage and splendid resolution will live in the traditions of the Royal Navy, and remain for many generations a fine and stirring memory. Weather, poor communication, poor planning and execution all led to the failure. It fell to Coastal Command in the early afternoon to try and redeem some success, and 7 217 Squadron Beauforts were ordered to launch from Thorny Island. 2 were loaded with bombs instead of torpedoes, and 1 became unserviceable. Eventually, only 4 took off for Manston to rendezvous with their fighter escorts. As a result of the delay, when the Beauforts arrived from Thorny Island and circled over the airfield, the fighters already departed Manston for the attack area. Having recently been upgraded to use RT, radio telephony, rather than wireless telegraphy, Morse code signals, the Beaufort did not receive WT messages that the fighter cover had in fact already departed. Pilot Officer Carson, in charge of the 217 Squadron attack, using his initiative, left the airfield circuit, heading for the last known location of the ships. However, 2 of his aircraft did not follow him and continued circling, eventually running out of fuel and landing at the airfield. The crews amazed the Manston ground staff, and they admitted to not knowing the operation's details. They were rapidly briefed, fueled and dispatched after the first 2 Beauforts. Coming up against a strong Luftwaffe force of ME-109s and FW-190s near the German fleet, all of Carson's Beauforts released their torpedoes under challenging attack profiles, but recorded no hits. Meanwhile, the three Beauforts late from Thorny Island arrived at Manston and started circling, like their predecessors. One landed and was briefed on the operation, took off and radioed the other two. All three headed for the German fleet, but getting close to torpedo release, the first aircraft was heavily damaged by flak and returned to Manston. But the coastal gunners at Ramsgate mistook it for a Heinkel and added further damage, and although not fatal, this meant a heroic landing was required at the airfield. The second aircraft was attacked by enemy fighters and heavily damaged, also managing to get back to Manston, but belly landing with its live torpedo due to significant undercarriage damage. Fortunately, despite a gentle landing, the torpedo tore off its cradle, but thankfully failed to explode. The final 217 Squadron Beaufort was also mauled by FW-190s after releasing its torpedo, which missed any targets and left Manston. This brave attempt by 217 Squadron Beauforts failed to hinder the German fleet, and although further Beauforts were sent to Thorny Island to bolster the attack, by the time they arrived from Centival, the weather had closed in and the German fleet slipped away into the mist. So ended Thorny Island's involvement in the Channel Dash. And on February the 12th each year, the memorial at the RAF Museum at Manston Airport, the 6th Fleet Air Arm Swordfish are remembered for their sacrifice, including, of course, Lieutenant Commander Esmond and the posthumous Victoria Cross he received for his gallantry in the attack.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Just as Extended is currently expanding your knowledge of RAF Coastal Command, you might be keen to widen your aviation history horizons in other directions as well. Did you know, for example, that around the time the Short Sunderland was entering RAF service, Shorts were breaking with their flying boat traditions and planning a long-range advanced land plane airliner? The project was halted on the outbreak of war, but you can read all about it in our latest edition, TAH-37. Did you also know about the British South Africa Police Reserve Air Wing, established in 1957, in which farmers and businessmen flew anti-guerrilla missions in their own civilian light aircraft, fitted with door-mounted machine guns and homemade grenade chutes? Or that Italy's mighty Isotta Fraschini Asso 750 aero engine, an 18-cylinder broad-arrow monster introduced in the early 1930s, which developed 850 horsepower, is still in production as a marine engine today, 90 years later? You can read in depth about all of this in issue 37 of The Aviation Historian and extend your knowledge. We're print, we're digital, but we're not on sale in newsagents. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com.
The following month, 217 Squadron left Thorny Island for RAF Lucas, and a day later was posted to the Far East. You can make from that what was thought of the leadership at the airfield. Winston Churchill ordered an inquiry into the debacle, but regardless, it remains a failure, and blame lies partly at the feet of the Thorny Island squadrons. 217 Squadron was replaced by Royal New Zealand Air Force 489 Squadron, who arrived in the Hamden in the dedicated anti-submarine role, carrying out its first torpedo attacks in July with sorties over the Trondheim Fjords. A further addition to the cocktail of aircraft at Thorny Island came that summer in the shape of Spitfire 5Bs from 129 Mysore Squadron, and shortly after joined by 130 Punjab Squadron Spitfires. Both aircraft were effectively sponsored by the Indian government, who raised bonds to support the war effort, paying for these aircraft. 129 Squadron undertook bomber escort duties before being used in fighter sweeps across France from Thorny Island, but was moved quickly out of this theatre and up to Scotland shortly afterwards. 130 Squadron Spitfires were actually based in Portreath, but would leave there early in the morning to stage out of Thorny Island and other airfields in the southeast of England for raids across France. By the end of the summer of 1942, the runways and perimeter tracks had been concreted. The two C-type hangars, damaged in earlier raids, were rebuilt, and over 20 blister hangars built around the field. The airfield was as busy as ever, with larger aircraft types starting to arrive. Thorny Island was becoming enormously active and slightly congested in his operations. That year, the airfield was also to play a part in Operation Jubilee, the ill-fated Dieppe landings. Both Spitfire squadrons provided air cover and air protection sorties for the 6,000 Allied troops and ships below them. Whilst the Spitfires fought valiantly, one was to be shot down, recording the unenviable title of being the first aircraft lost in this battle. As with the Channel Dash, this operation failed, and Thorney mourned the lost airmen and the 4,000 men who never returned from the ground forces. The summer also saw the arrival of Armstrong Whitworth Whitley GR Mark 7s with 612 Squadron in the anti-submarine role, operating out across the Channel approaches. More heavies arrived in the form of consolidated Liberator 3s with 59 Squadron returning after only recently converting from Hudson 3s. Longer range reconnaissance and anti-sub operations were starting to see patrols along most of the French coastline, and the noose around the U-boats escaping to the Atlantic from ports such as Brest was tightened. With more Liberators arriving to the UK from US production lines, an operational training unit was formed at the airfield with 86 Squadron. More non-flying staff and crews added to the activity at Thorney Island as it further grew in both movements and contribution to the war effort. With autumn looming, 612 Squadron Whitley's left for Scotland, but more arrivals from 131 Squadron with Spitfire 5Bs and the Fleet Air Arm with Swordfish 2s from 816 and 819 Squadrons making up the numbers. The challenge of all the aircraft types, speed, skills of the pilots must have kept the controllers and ground crews very busy at this time. Accounts of the noise of the airfield operation suggest it was rarely quiet, but given it was still a remote piece of peninsula, it probably wasn't too bad for the locals. The weather was unseasonal during the winter of 1942-1943, and airfield operations continued unabated. 415 Squadron's Hamdens returned to continue anti-shipping operations, and more Swordfish were back on the field, this time with 836 Squadron arriving from St. Merin. Arriving and departing squadrons made the airfield transient in its feel, yet the machine ploughed onwards, and early in the new year saw the exciting arrival of Boeing Fortress 2As with 59 Squadron converting up from Liberators. With 53 Squadron converting to the Liberator 5s that year, long-range patrols were being operated from Thorney Island of up to 13 hours in length across the Bay of Biscay and out over the Channel approaches. With Canada's 415 Squadron returning to Thorney Island and later converting to the Wellington Mark 13, coverage of the sea lanes and U-boat areas south of the English coast and as far as the northern coast of Spain were also being undertaken. The Bay of Biscay, where the U-boats could transit to the wider Atlantic Ocean, Irish Sea, northern approaches and the North Sea, was now being covered from both 16 Group and Thorney Island, and the eastern Atlantic areas covered by 19 Group from southwest airfields. The 836 Squadron Swordfish again departed, this time to Macrahanish, and the airfield was once again left exclusively in the hands of RAF's Coastal Command, although a flight of 415 Squadron did take surplus ferry albacores late in the year and used them effectively against German E-boats operating in the English Channel. It was mid-war, and the Allies were still calling on these stable biplane airplanes to deliver torpedo attacks. Although the main part of 415 left Thorney in November, A-Flight and their albacores proved so successful that they remained operating from Thorney Island. More Wellington 11s came to Thorney Island from RAF Holmsey South with 547 Squadron, a newly formed anti-shipping and anti-submarine specialist unit. They immediately upgraded the aircraft to Wellington Mark 13s, and only 1 month later upgraded again to Liberator Mark 5s, leaving shortly after for Aldergrove. Whilst based at Thorney Island, along with 53, 59 and 415 squadrons, they provided long-range anti-submarine and anti-shipping cover across the Bay of Biscay, helping to turn the war against the U-boat threat to the Allied Atlantic convoys. As the new year of 1944 arrived, the airfield was unusually quiet. After all the hectic comings and goings of squadrons, aircraft and crews, a tranquil period sat over the airfield, except for occasional sorties from 415 Squadron's A-Flight albacores, still in residence and still patrolling the Channel, seeking out German torpedo boats. This quiet spell was all part of the Allies' plan for the next stage of the war, and the part that RAF Thorney Island was still to play. Still technically in the operational control of Coastal Command's 16 Group, the airfield was to be taken over by the 2nd Tactical Air Force. Formed in the summer of 1943 to prepare for the invasion of Europe, it consumed units from both fighter and bomber command. Hawker Typhoon 1Bs from 164 Squadron, Argentine British, a donation squadron by the British community in Argentina, arrived early in the new year, joined by 193 Squadron, a 2+4, two heads are better than one, a dedicated fighter ground attack squadron. They combined to make number 83 Composite Group. Further additions came from 183 Gold Coast Squadron and 609 West Riding Squadron and 198 Squadron, all with Typhoon 1Bs. The sound levels around the airfield must have gone from quiet to deafening as the mighty Sabre engines of the Typhoons roared throughout the days of the early summer of 1944 as offensive operations across the Channel increased in preparation for D-Day. On the morning of Operation Overlord, 198 Squadron Typhoons were the first to depart at first light and attacked a German mobile column, destroying several vehicles using rockets and machine gun fire. As the Gold Coast Squadron Typhoons crossed the French coast, the Luftwaffe was now alerted and flying defensive sorties against Allied aircraft. They suffered heavily against ME-109s and German flak. 164 Squadron Typhoons dogfighting over the Calais area and were able to bring down two FW-190s for no loss that day. For the next 48 hours, all the available Typhoons at Thorney Island were in operation over mainland Europe, and for the next 2 weeks kept up a significant number of sorties as the Allies gained the foothold on the continent they needed and started making progress inland. However, on the 17th and 18th of June, to help stage operations further up the front, the Typhoons left Thorney Island for forward bases and other RAF airfields. There was no respite, as one day later, number 140 wing of number 2 group 2nd Tactical Air Force arrived in the form of 21, 464 and 487 squadrons with Mosquito FB-6s. Originally used in the day and night fighter role, these were the early Mosquitoes to enter service with Coastal Command. Already well experienced in the strike role, having undertaken the memorable strike on the jail at Amiens, the wing immediately commenced operations at both day and night as far inland as Germany itself. With as many as 20 sorties a day from Thorney Island, on July 14th they delivered 9 tons of bombs accurately on the German Gestapo headquarters at Bonneville-Mator, leaving the surrounding villages untouched. They repeated this feat on a German barracks just 2 weeks later. The wing continued strikes throughout September and October, but as the weather deteriorated and the war progressed towards its final stages, bombing operations from Thorney Island slowed down. Although the weather remained wintry over Christmas, early in 1945, 21 Squadron shot down two of the last V-1s launched against Britain. All V-1s were targeted at Tower Bridge in London, and although none hit the target, these would have brought havoc across the London area. With this and fewer strike missions completed, the wing moved on from Thorney Island, but left a legacy of successful operations from the base. The airfield returned to Coastal Command operations in January with the secondment of 810 Squadron from the Fleet Air Arm with Barracuda 2s and 822 Squadron Barracuda 3s fitted with new ASV-3 radar, which was to be tested on anti-shipping operations across the Channel. 822 Squadron was formed from crews working up through 713 Squadron at Ronald's Way before moving to 744 Squadron at Maydown near Londonderry to start anti-submarine operations. The belief that both German submarines and E-boats were operating close to British shores was borne by the tragedy at Slapton Sands for Operation Tiger, the secret mission to prepare for the Allied invasion of Normandy. 9 E-boats on patrol out of Cherbourg struck the training exercise vessels with the loss of almost 750 United States GIs. Lieutenant Derek Armson of the squadron relates the background and training before 822 deployed to Thorney Island.
Whilst we were at Maydown, they were on the south coast, through the channel, the Germans were operating miniature U-boats, small U-boats, against shipping going across to supply the forces that by this time were into France and so on. And so we were sent to, first of all, to an RAF base at Thorney Island near Portsmouth. And we were based there, and we had two operations to do. One was to there was this anti-submarine patrol across the French coast, and the other was a dawn and dusk flight around the Channel Isles, because when the Allies went into France, they'd bypassed the Channel Isles because they were so incredibly heavily fortified. It would have been a waste of thousands of lives to attack them, so they isolated them. And, of course, they had no nothing much left of the Germans on the Channel Isles. Had a very little fuel left and very much of anything, really. But so what they were doing, the Germans were doing, they were sending out raiding parties to little towns on the French coast from Jersey and Guernsey during the night to get supplies and come back. And we were supposed to go around at dawn and dusk to try and spot these and either attack them or report back so that someone else, the army or someone, could do it. So we were at Thorney Island doing that. And also we're looking for shipping, small ships that were going from there across to the Channel Islands, to France.
And did you spot anything during that? Do you remember any significant patrols?
Well, the only thing that we spotted on one occasion, we thought we'd seen a submarine periscope looking down, and you could see this thing, and you could tell from the way the tide was going, it was like a wake, and as it was moving along. My observer spotted it first, and he said, look, a submarine periscope. So we circled around and came down, and we had depth charges on at the time, that's what we were dropping, and we were diving in towards it, and I was all ready to let these go, and he said, well, this is great, he said, well, let these go, he said, we'll get rid of this lot, and we'll get a DSO or something for you, so you could see a medal. Just at the last minute, as I was about to press the button and release these things, I suddenly realised it wasn't a periscope, it was a fisherman's buoy for crab pots or lobster pots or something. So we didn't let it go. But no, we didn't see that, didn't have any action on that. We did have a rather frightening moment or two on one morning. We were flying around Jersey, and it was a lovely day. Or a lovely morning, bright early, just getting light, and I saw these clouds. It was a cloudy day, you know, puffs of cloud, and I saw these small clouds, and they're sort of not white, they were sort of slightly grey.
By the way, have you noticed them ripples down by the starboard wing? And they used to fire these Oerlikon cannons, and because we were about 100 feet off the sea, you could see the ripples coming up.
And there was another one, and another one. And then it suddenly dawned on me, they were shooting at us. They were actually shells exploding. So they better get out of here.
I later visited the fort where the Oerlikon cannons were on. They used to take pot shots of this. And we didn't actually put our fingers up to our nose. But we really shouldn't have done that, tempt them and everything like that.
And that was round, that was in April, March and April we were doing that.
And did it, because the miniature submarines, were they difficult to spot?
Very difficult, because they were, it wasn't so much the submarine, you're looking for a submarine, it's the, when they have the periscope up, you can see that, because as it's going along, because it makes a wake. And it's amazing how, with certain times of the night, when you get this phosphorescence at sea, and you can see it very clearly. But you very rarely actually see them unless they come up on the surface. But they were after ships, supply ships, they came up around Yarmouth, Great Yarmouth, around Norfolk, and down the east coast, Kent, and along the south coast, to intercept ships, only for a certain length of time, because it all came to an end. But that's what we were supposed to be doing, or what we were doing.
So that was Thorney Island, and that's the sort of spring.
That was the Thorney Island. Yes. That was the Thorney Island. Then all of a sudden, we were told to up sticks and fly to Manston in Kent. Now Manston was another RAF station. We weren't there very long, but we went from Thorney Island to there. Again, it was looking for these midget U-boats coming up the coast, up the Thames estuary.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Throughout March and April, they worked daily sweeping flights, hunting the channel for E-boats. Some sorties were monotonous, but there was good food, and morale was also good, being in the Fleet Air Arm, but based on an RAF station.
Our squadron, by the time we got on it, they got rid of the Swordfish, and we were on these Barracudas. And it was quite nice going on Dawn Patrol, because what we used to do is go in the canteen, and there was nice bacon and eggs served up by the Italians who used to be prisoner of wars, and we used to have our bacon and eggs and go on Dawn Patrol.
822 Squadron were also joined by the Fleet Air Arms Air Sea Warfare Development Unit, 703 Squadron, who had the objective of seeking new and enhanced methods of anti-ship operations. It flew several types of aircraft from Thorny Island before the end of the war, including Avengers, Fireflies, Sea Hornets, as well as Barracudas. Spitfire 5Bs from 278 Squadron arrived early in the year, but these were rapidly moved on to other duties as the squadron converted to the Sea Otter Mark II. A dedicated search and rescue squadron, the Sea Otter provided to be a useful aircraft in rescuing downed air crews from many coastal command theatres. The squadron later disbanded at Thorny Island. In June, 848 Squadron with Avengers supporting Coastal Command arrived at Thorny Island, joining 822 Squadron's Barracudas in channel sweeps. With its longer duration, Avengers were out on sorties for up to 5 hours, whereas the Barracudas had a shorter duration of around 3 to 4 hours. 848 Squadron Avengers returned to Fleet Air Arm operations and were sent on to HMS Formidable, and in contrast to serving what has been noted with the slightly more relaxed RAF Coastal Command culture for the Telegraphist air gunners, they had a wake-up call. This from R. Fletcher's frontline Avenger squadrons of the Fleet Air Arm. 4 of them were unfortunate to be found on the mess desk during the course of the first lieutenant's rounds and were immediately accused of skulking away to avoid work duties. For the past few months, operating from RAF stations, TAGs, as aircrew, were not expected to undertake anything other than their flying duties, but that excuse cut no ice with the first lieutenant, and he forthwith detailed them to help offload the ship. They were given the task of securing Corsair drop tanks, using pulleys and wires to load these up onto shelving. Unfortunately for the TAGs, the operator operating the pulleys failed to stop when it reached the top, and the crates with tanks holding either side crashed to the deck. 2 broke their legs and left the squadron, and the other 2 spent a spell in the sick bay. The irony from one of the later TAGs was that this was the only injury he received during his service, having survived operations in the Channel and Pacific without a scratch. As the war ended, Thorny Island was back in Fleet Air Arm hands, and operations were quickly run down. Squadrons disbanded or moved elsewhere, and the airfield was left in the hands of the development unit. During its peak, RAF Thorny Island had between 3,000 and 4,000 personnel on station. It was a bustling and busy environment. Multiple Allied aircrews from across the world must have given it a strong cosmopolitan feel. Ground crews and service staff, WAFs, WRENs, as well as establishment staff added to the mix of roles and staff on station. It must have been great to be a people watcher, seeing the aircraft taking off and landing all hours of the day and night. After the war, the base continued to operate as an RAF station, but was retired from flying duties and is now an Army Logistics and Missile Defence base. Some elements of the airfield still exist today, and the church graveyard is home to several war graves from the conflict, a constant reminder of the sacrifices of both Coastal Command and other air units who used the base during World War II. We would like to thank Robin Brooks for his support in our research for this feature. If you want to find out more about the work Robin has done on World War II airfields, pick up a copy of his book, Sussex Airfields in the Second World War, published by Countryside Books. We also used several other sources for this research, including Stuka Attack by Andy Saunders, rafweb.org and the local parish website, stnicholastimeline.org.uk. We're grateful to the Imperial War Museum for the use of the interview with Derek Armson. If you want to listen to this interview, We'll put links to the Imperial War Museum pages in the show notes for this episode. If you want to listen to the full interview with P.O. Johnson, then go to our extended feature on the Barracuda, episode number 73.
So that's chapter 9, looking at RAF Thorney Island. I'd like to thank Gareth for doing a superb job in converting my research into a listenable chapter for you. This is the final chapter in this first phase of our Coastal Command series and brings the series to a close for now. We're currently considering future chapters later this year, but we'll only do this if the interest is there for it. So please send us your feedback on the chapters we've already published, and if you'd be interested in us adding further chapters to the series. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contribution to this show. We'd also like to thank the extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at The Aviation Historian and Dave Homewood at the Wings Over New Zealand podcast. We're extremely grateful to Osprey Publishing and Helium Books for supporting the series. You can find me, Peter Johnson, on Twitter at Nascot Hornet, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.